ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Most people in Australia making policy about housing don't want house prices to fall.
Oh, very simply, they cut my limbs off.
On Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor, we crack open money, relationships and the stories shaping your life.
I'm nobody's darling, believe you me.
Big questions, real solutions. Life Matters is where your stories shape the national conversation. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Hamish McDonald.
We look ahead to the big conference in Munich today that you're going to be reading about all week, I suspect.
Plus, your questions answered. Could a US election ever be cancelled? And what would it take for that to happen?
And closer to home, why don't we do more with and talk more about Indonesia?
And we have a special guest, fresh from Washington. That's all coming up on Global Roaming Your Call. Well, lots to talk about today, Geraldine, but as always on a Monday, we want to look at the week ahead and I guess set the scene for some of the headlines we're expecting to emerge. And I think it's fair to say a lot of them are going to come out of the Munich Security Conference that's taking place from the 13th to the 15th of February. But over the last few years, certainly, it's generated huge global headlines. We expect the coming days are going to be no different.
Yes, look, I mean, it's really a few decades old now, and it was a small conference. No, but, you know, it was one of those arcane conferences that were held in Europe, I think not really exceeding more than a few dozen people.
To be blunt, it was a pretty boring affair. Like, when I was based in London and covering Europe, it was something that maybe you'd get an accreditation for and pop into if you had the time. But if there was a bigger story, it's not something that you would necessarily clear the calendar for. I think now for the kind of journalists and the analysts of Europe and the world, this is now a must-watch event.
Well, maybe particularly post the Cold War. Certainly, you know, the conference went beyond the Western Bloc and people from Central and Eastern Europe came, and Russia, I think the Russians also came. And it's still very transatlantic at its heart, as people say, but it really is a venue and a sort of, it's the meeting ground of a much wider range of global voices. And of course, the speech that came out of last year's Munich Security Conference is one that won't be forgotten easily.
You're talking about J.D. Vance, are you?
I am, the new sheriff in town.
In Washington, there is a new sheriff in town. And under Donald Trump's leadership, we may disagree with your views, but we will fight to defend your right to offer it in the public square, agree or disagree. Now, to many of us on the other side of the Atlantic, it looks more and more like old entrenched interests hiding behind ugly Soviet-era words like misinformation and disinformation, who simply don't like the idea that somebody with an alternative viewpoint might express a different opinion or, God forbid, vote a different way or, even worse, win an election.
Of course, that's US Vice President J.D. Vance speaking at the security conference last year, which, quite frankly, I think it was an incredibly tough, strident tone. I think the shockwaves were extraordinary.
I mean, there was outrage.
There was outrage.
In the European continent.
Absolute outrage.
I think there was context for that outrage as well, Geraldine, because, of course, Elon Musk had been appearing virtually at rallies for the Alternative for Deutschland, the right-wing party in ahead of the German elections. And there was a sense that maybe this new US administration was actually actively trying to intervene in and manipulate the democratic politics of European countries, which are supposed to be allies.
It was the beginning, you know, how I've said before that I had that period last year when I realised that I really sort of, for about 3 weeks, I thought, you know, Trump has changed sides to be pro-Russian. And I just sort of didn't know what to do with myself because I was so stunned. And it did actually start with Vance. Vance started to talk about them as sort of desiccated, you know, decaying societies. And then he started to talk about, in effect, intervening in things like the German cultural stability, which was quite extraordinary. And if you actually bother to Google it, it's fascinating how there's been a long-running debate at the Munich Security Conference about whether the Alternative for Germany, which is now the party that is the official opposition, it's very much an extreme right-wing party, but it is now the biggest opposition force in German politics. And different people at the helm of the Munich Security Conference have kept them out, and others have brought them in. And the question is whether they are a challenge to the German constitution to ensure that they never, ever, ever drift back to those shocking times of the Nazi period. Now, they're coming this time. They're coming this year. There's really quite a lot at stake about how you have a proper politically inclusive conversation in Europe at the moment. And that'll be played out at this particular conference.
And in part, that's one of the reasons why there's a particular word that's getting used a lot, a German word, Zeitenwende, which means turning point.
I mean, it's all to do with whether the Europeans are prepared to spend more money on their defence, because that was a sort of the underlying motive of Trump getting involved in the first place.
But the point is they are.
They are, in theory. You know, some people believe that it was 3 years ago that Olaf Scholz talked about that big turning point in the Reichstag, and they were all on their feet applauding that they were going to spend far more money on retooling and rearming. But they still only got 75,000, I see, in their as a standing army. The spending arguably is a bit pitiful. They've got defence industry is actually bigger than we think. But as for sort of building something that could be mobilised and it looks like an army, it's still in a very early day.
But then contrast that to the Poles, who investing heavily, getting up to 6% of GDP. Unquestionably, this is a country that is preparing itself for the possibility of conflict.
Yeah, and what I'm going to be listening for is how they talk about this so that their people, Germans and other Europeans, can say, oh yes, we see the dilemma, we're prepared to think about it. I haven't heard anything like that, really.
So, Gerry, a big week ahead, obviously, a lot up for discussion on global roaming. I can sort of almost intuit the episodes you're thinking of as this all bubbles along. Yes. But let's get into your call and tackle some of your questions. Thanks so much for sending them in. And we've got a very special guest to help us with that.
Yes, to help us answer your questions on your call today, Carrington Clark is freshly home from Washington, D.C. as the ABC's North America correspondent, and we're absolutely delighted to welcome him. Hi there, Carrington.
Thank you so much for having me.
How long were you in Washington?
So in the end, I served just under 4 years. So I had most of Joe Biden's administration, but then also went through the craziness that is the Donald Trump second administration. It is nice to be home. Sydney is very warm. I'm missing some pretty atrocious weather in Washington, D.C. But, you know, I am missing probably an hour and a half fix of Donald Trump every single day. I think it's finally out of my system. It's kind of going through rehab. But it is, my colleagues are still over there. It is an extraordinary time, obviously, to be reporting.
You use the word served. You make it sound like a prison sentence being in the United States.
At times you feel like you're locked into something. Your time is not your own. And Donald Trump has a habit of working quite late into the night. In the first term, I think it was more about tweeting out things. It's now more about Truth Social posts. But it is an interesting position in that the story you think you're going to be telling at any particular day is often very different by that night. He has a way of sucking up all the oxygen.
Okay, let's get to our first question today. It comes from Sean.
Is there a scenario, e.g. Trump declares war on Cuba, Iran, insert the name of many unstable countries, whereby the Trump government could cancel the US midterm elections?
So, Carrington, we've actually had quite a few people writing to us about this with similar versions of that question. What's your take on it? How real is the prospect of Trump actually trying to cancel an election, whether it's midterms or actual presidential elections?
I mean, it's a legitimate question that he has now a history of making remarks that seems to suggest that he's at least quandering the question, and he's open
quandering.
To the possibility. Yes, he's open to the possibility, if you will. And this is one of the difficulties with trying to cover Donald Trump. He often will say things that could be a joke, they could be a question, they could be off the cuff, they could be something he's considered. And often I think he is trying to test exactly what the response will be. When it comes to this question about whether or not, first of all, the federal government should be more involved in the administration of the elections. That seems to be something that he wants to do. His press secretary has kind of been forced into this position of almost pushing back on his commentary to say, oh, no, that's not exactly what he means. It's not that the federal government should take over the election. It's just that we want to make sure that people need to use IDs in order to vote. But he himself has said very explicitly that there are certain states that he believes he needs to take over and that the federal government needs to be involved in that process. Now, obviously, this is a man who has continued to claim that the 2020 election was stolen from him. He seems to genuinely believe that. The Justice Department is getting files from states in America to try to see whether or not there was any voter disenfranchisement. But I have done a bit of a deep dive. I'm not a constitutional expert on this issue, but it seems pretty clear that the president does not have the legal authority to cancel elections.
But what if there is a conflict? What if it's wartime? Or what if there's some kind of military declaration over a particular state, for example? What does that do to the possibility that we're talking about?
We had this interesting moment when Donald Trump appeared next to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky when they were talking about the fact that Ukraine couldn't hold elections, they said, because they were in a war. And Donald Trump suggested, well, perhaps if there's a war happening when my term comes up, perhaps we won't be able to have elections. That was laughed off at the time, but it's, again, something that's bubbling across. Outside a full-blown military coup, though, it's hard to see how Donald Trump can do this legally. The U.S. Constitution specifically states that a new Congress has to form at the start of January of next year. Then the actual date of the election is written into legislation. It's a law, so Congress, in theory, might be able to change that date, but they would still have to have some mechanism to make sure the new Congress takes hold in January of next year. And then the states themselves are the ones who actually administer the election. So unless Donald Trump is literally going to declare martial law or a coup with military involvement, he doesn't appear to have any legal reason to move or cancel that election.
The irony is we say, oh, we've got national control of elections. The AEC runs our elections and there's nothing like that in the states. And we've always felt that that actually predisposed them to all sorts of issues in terms of how they vote and so on. You couldn't do this in the US, could you not? Like it would go to the Supreme Court, states would take it if he tried it.
The states have the power of the election. That's explicitly clear in America. And yes, they don't have the equivalent of an Australian Electoral Commission. In America, elections are very political and individual states could completely change the way their election is run, including preferential voting or first past the post, etc. And of course, they have a huge amount of power over the individual seats in Congress, the borders, the gerrymandering that goes on in the United States.
And just for listeners, maybe it's worth saying, this is not just the congressional elections you're talking about. This is also when there is a presidential election. Within the state, it is the state that runs the voting process. So there are different processes depending on which state you are in. It might be physically the way you vote, but it might also be the way the ballot is drawn. There's essentially, it's a completely disaggregated system.
That's exactly right. And it was by design. Remember, this is the United States of America. There is a huge emphasis on state power within America. And yes, the president is the person who is in charge, the CEO, if you will, of the country, the commander in chief. But he gets there not through direct election from the people, but from the states. And the states decide how their populations decide on their electoral college votes, how they work, how they get to that number. And then from that, they elect the president.
And of course, in theory, one could say that they are held up for voting by their own people when they go to election. I'm trying to think, what would be the accountability for that? It's whether they remain popular with their own voters.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the states also have elections. The governor of the state is elected by the people of that state. But the states have huge amount of power in America. And that is a major check on Donald Trump. And interestingly, the Republican Party's always kind of been the party for states' rights, right? That is, they're the party who say the states' rights should not be overridden by national concerns. But Donald Trump, once again, suggesting he actually thinks, at least while he's in charge, it should be the national government that gets to decide on these big issues.
I noticed that the New York Times today says about the Attorney General Pam Bondi sending a threatening letter to Democratic officials in one of those states, Minnesota, suggesting the administration might wind down its immigration enforcement efforts there in exchange for concessions, including handing over its voter data.
I mean, quite extraordinary, isn't it? And this is where the question is a valid one from your listener. Donald Trump is testing the boundaries of his power, right? He's like this chaos agent who's within the system. It's kind of when you do like a software test and you get them people to try the most extreme things to find the limitations of that system. Donald Trump is doing that to the American Constitution and the relationship between the states and the national government. He's not bound by the usual rules of how you think conventionally you should be able to interact. And so, yes, this is another example where they think they can get something, which is what they want, which is voter registration.
Why do they want that?
I think he does seem to genuinely believe that elections are rigged against him and against the Republicans, and he wants anything he can hold up as evidence that is in some way occurring.
The unfortunate reality of this being podcast medium is that you can't see the shaking of Geraldine Doon's head that is going on in disbelief, I think.
Look, maybe we should move to Minnesota, given that they're talking about Minnesota there, because he's now talking about pulling out, I think, 500 ICE agents out of Minnesota. Does that imply a real setback? How do I read that in your view? You've just been there. How do I read that?
I think Minnesota has proven to be, I think, for many Americans, a bridge too far. Although Americans seemed, particularly at the start of Donald Trump's term, seemed to be very on board with his strong border protection message, the fact that he managed to basically get border crossings across the southern border almost to zero. People seemed to be in support of that. He promised, you know, an historic number of taking people out of the system and sending them home. And people were on board with that, I think, up until the point with what we've seen in Minnesota. And I think the scenes that we have seen, the conflict between protesters and ICE agents and federal law enforcement, has shocked people. And obviously the deaths of two Americans, I think for many people was just, it went too far. And so there does seem to be an element of damage control. And he has seemingly sidelined his Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, and now has put in the border czar, Tom Holman, and to kind of change the strategy. But even if they take out, I think, 500 or 700 or whatever the number is, agents, there's still, I believe, a couple of thousand left in place, and that's a lot of people.
So before we get to our next listener question, I did just want to get your read on the position of the chair of the Federal Reserve, because Jerome Powell's term is coming up. Trump has made no secret of his dislike of Powell. Who's the person in the frame to replace him?
First of all, important to point out, though, Jerome Powell was actually appointed by Donald Trump, right? This is a guy who just fell foul of him, but it was Donald Trump's pick to put him into the chair position. So goes to show how potentially dangerous this job and how little job security it comes with. There were expectations, I think, that Donald Trump would try and find someone who would bend easily to Donald Trump's will when it comes to interest rates. He keeps talking about how he's a low interest rate guy. He believes interest rates should be 1%. That's going to help fuel economic growth. He's been so critical of Jerome Powell. But instead, he did kind of surprise people with the appointment, as Donald Trump calls it, from central casting. He loves using this terminology. Seems to suggest he likes the aesthetics as much as anything. But Kevin Warsh has already served on the Federal Reserve previously as one of the governors. He's actually seen as a hawk, which is what we call someone who believes in higher interest rates generally. So it seems like a strange choice. And I think it is going to be fascinating to see how he now goes through the confirmation process.
But isn't it also a truth about Trump, forgive that term, that he does care what the markets do and think? And so he would be as interested in selecting someone to which the markets would respond well.
I think this is right. There was, at the very start of the second Trump term where I was there, early on, particularly when he was going hard on the tariff issue, there was some chatter about, oh my God, maybe Trump isn't actually as scared of the bond market and stock market falling as he was in his first term. Maybe he's now, because he's been reelected, he's actually unbridled and he'll do whatever he wants because he doesn't actually care if the markets fall in the short term. I think that's proven to be incorrect.
Well, then Scott Bessent actually talked to him, didn't he?
Exactly.
Wake up.
Well, Carrington, thanks very much for dropping by. I guess we'll hear your coverage of whatever happens with the Federal Reserve on Radio National Breakfast.
Great to be here. Thanks, guys.
Okay, Jerry, we're going to come a little bit closer to home with this next question. It comes from Bella.
Just wondering why our close neighbours Indonesia don't seem to rate more highly as a focus for discussion of many current concerns: international defence, foreign policy, trade markets, social religious coercions, etc., when they are right next door with huge population, mostly Muslim, and it seems logical and prudent to develop good relations as a priority for mutual benefit in our region.
Yes, look, this is something that we have talked about a lot, Hamish and I, because, in fact, we've done a couple of episodes in Indonesia. You believe, don't you, Hamish, that we don't do nearly enough? I believe that too. But it is interesting. I think the Australian listeners' curiosity for Indonesia is boundaried, if I can put it like that.
Now, is what you're saying that when we do episodes on Indonesia, less people listen to them than pretty much anything else we do?
I regret to say that's more or less true, and which I find quite distressing, because I've been fascinated by Indonesia for a long, long time. But look, I've thought a lot about this question, Bella, and you know, over the years, I've tried to do interviews over many years about Indonesia, and I was quite helped by a judgment by one of our besties, now dead, Jamie Mackey, very much loved academic, distinguished scholar, helped dismantle a White Australia policy, devoted his life to educating the broader public about Indonesia. And he used to say, "Don't expect us to be bosom buddies or the greatest of mates. Allow us to be good neighbours." That's what Australia and Indonesia should aim for, just like you do in a street. You know, some people you get along terribly well with and your lives become intertwined. Others, you have a very good civil relationship, and you don't push the relationship beyond its easy limits. Now, I actually found that was his judgment after many years of absorbing himself in it. I found that quite helpful, and that's what I sort of decided to bring to my reporting.
I think I'd say a few things about this. And by the way, we are going to be doing more on Indonesia this year. I'll be in Indonesia in a few months' time. The show will be coming to you from Indonesia, and we're really looking forward to delivering on that. Within foreign policy circles, there's often a lot of discussion of trying to move the relationship between Australia and Indonesia beyond what they call the three Bs: boats, beef, and barley. These are the issues that seem to have defined the relationship for many years. I think, to my mind, though, there's important context there that if you go back to the end of the Suharto era and the East Timor question, there was genuine distrust and animosity, and it may have taken over time a turn for the worse. I think if you look at the timeline since Indonesian independence, unquestionably, the Australian relationship with Indonesia has improved. It may be subtle, it may not be the giant strides that some might hope for, but it is moving in a positive direction. Australia's really benefited from a few things, I think, that since the fall of the Suharto regime, Indonesia has had pretty free, pretty fair, pretty open democratic elections. Mm. It's had peaceful transfer of power. There's been two long-term presidents, most recently being SBY, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, and then President Jokowi. Both served for the full 2 5-year terms. So that's given Australia a 20-year run of solid, reliable, and reasonably predictable democratic rule in Indonesia. And we have actually benefited from that. The current president, Prabowo, former defence minister, former son-in-law of Suharto, is a more complex character. If it's not necessarily about being best friends, it's a pretty predictable relationship at the moment.
All of that is absolutely right. But for instance, there was a dramatic drop in the Indonesian stock exchange last week, I think it was. It was a very significant double-digit drop. Now, it got almost no coverage in Australia.
Oh, we barely cover Indonesia Australia.
Know, the mutual curiosity, because if you're in Indonesia, as I've been many times, there's not much interest in Australia. There's very much interest in the big boys and North Asia. I think they could be far more interested in Australia. But we are not interested in... sufficiently curious about it, Indonesia too. So all of this would go to Jamie Mackey's point. Look, beyond a certain point, you know, you deal with that. You don't let the best be the enemy of the good. You get on with what you're dealing with and make what you've got good.
I also think in Australia, it's not uniform. the levels of interest in Indonesia and Southeast Asia more broadly. You know, you spend time in Cairns or Darwin or even Perth. I think there are different perspectives on Southeast Asia. You know, yes. Some of these places feel more, I guess, orientated to the neighbourhood than what it would feel if you're in Adelaide or Canberra or Melbourne or Sydney.
Quite true. Look, I've always wished and hoped that there would be more comfortable interaction of people, of our personalities. And, you know, there's another lovely man, Julian Disney, who was a lot of listeners will know of him. He used to really specialise in people-to-people contact, and he would bring down the head of a hospital in Indonesia to meet the head of a hospital here. He believed it had to be far more targeted and to build up relationships, not on this big level, but on the smaller level. And I think he was quite successful.
Well, Bella, it's a great question. We really appreciate it. We hope we've delivered something for you to think about in response. Fairly neatly, Geraldine, I think that brings us to our next question, which has come via email from Ken.
I wonder why Australia isn't more aligned with Asian countries than European countries and America. Is it because Australia is populated mainly of people of Europe?
Well, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has actually just been in Jakarta to sign a security treaty with the Indonesian government. And it's one of these sort of joint obligation agreements. There's some argument about how meaningful it ultimately would be. But under the pact, the two countries would agree to consider a joint military response if either comes under attack. A lot of experts, though, pointing out that Indonesia's agreeing to do this with us at the same time as building closer relationships with countries like China, like Russia. And given their broader position on geopolitical affairs, one might wonder what this would mean in the event that something like that actually happened. The Australian government, though, says it shows the relationship is as strong as it ever has been. Here's Penny Wong on Radio National.
This is the most important step we have taken in over three decades. Indonesia is central to Australia's security, so I'm really honoured to be part of the visit.
I confess I would love Penny Wong, I must admit, to flesh it out a little more. You know, I think we could have a bit more descriptive language from people about what are the nature of the friendships being made, both with the Pacific and with Southeast Asia. And I mean, I wish the journalists would ask for more, for example, questions so that we get more of a sense of it being less abstract. I do yearn for that.
Yeah, you might be expecting a lot of the foreign minister based on the oratory performances I've observed.
Yeah, but I know and I understand the caution. By God, I can understand the caution. You wouldn't rabbit on at the moment. It's a bit of a volatile world. But I still think the business of expanding the sense of how are we building these friendships? Give us a sense of it, please. That's what I would, anyway, I would like to hear more.
Look, I've been reading, as you know, recently about sort of Indonesia's pathway to independence. And what I think has been a really valuable reminder for me is the sort of colonial experience of the Indonesians, whilst occurring concurrently with Australia and the rest of the region, was very different. They were occupied by the Dutch. And then they were occupied by the Japanese during the Second World War. And Sukarno and the other independence leaders sort of utilised the Japanese as a way of ejecting the Dutch. It's an extraordinary story and pathway to independence. And I think it would do us well, perhaps, to kind of familiarise ourselves more with that story, to understand why it is today that maybe there is this caution, which sometimes is inexplicable to us.
Couldn't agree more. You absolutely. I want a television series. Do another one, Hamish, on that. Well, look, thank you very much for your company on this Your Call episode. Keep sending us the questions you would like us to answer. global.roaming@abc.net.au.
And just a reminder, Geraldine did say on air she doesn't want all the lovely, beautiful feedback.
I did. I said we can take critique as well.
I'll be back with Kylie tomorrow for another episode, and our guest is Martin Luther King III. He's in Australia, and we're really looking forward to sharing that interview with you. Bye-bye, Jerry.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.